from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A long-awaited referendum that offered the independence of Scotland from the United Kingdom went down with a no vote of 55% to 45%. There was a record turnout. RT's Polly Boyko was in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh, for the outcome.
Scotland has rejected independence. 55% have voted no to independence. 45% voted yes. Now, we're yet to receive one final count, but I suspect the people that are counting those final votes will be feeling that they're pretty futile. We've already had David Cameron speaking outside Downing Street. He was talking about how there is clear support for maintaining the union. Let's take a listen to what he said now.
Now the debate has been settled for a generation, or as Alex Salmond has said, perhaps for a lifetime. So there can be no disputes, no reruns. We have heard the settled will of the Scottish people.
Well, Alex Salmond spoke just after David Cameron. He had an emotional speech up on stage in Edinburgh a little bit earlier, talking about just how many people voted for independence, 1.6 million people. And he said that all those people that voted yes, they won't be expecting things to go back to business as usual in politics again. They want change, and they'll be expecting Westminster to deliver on all those promises that they've made coming up to the referendum.
We have seen a scare and a fear of enormous proportions, not the scaremongering directed at the Scottish people, but the scare and the fear at the heart of the Westminster establishment as they realised the mass movement of people that was going forward in Scotland.
This has been a comfortable victory for the No campaign. The margin really wasn't quite as narrow as some people expected it to be going into the polls. Now, I'm sure that we can hear the sighs of relief of the Better Together campaign across the country. And this is just the start for the politicians in Westminster. Their work, they really have it cut out for them. They need to start delivering on all those promises, as Alex Salmond has been saying. And it's not just about Scotland anymore. There's talk of devolving greater powers to England and to Wales as well. But just a few hours ago, nobody knew which way this vote was going to go. It was on a knife edge. And I think that the politicians south of the border in London will be feeling as though they have had a very close shave.
Chris Bambury is an author, journalist, and political analyst. He spoke with RT's Peter Laveau from Edinburgh Friday.
The vote failed because essentially the United Kingdom establishment, the elite in Britain, threw everything they could, but the kitchen sink, to try and intimidate and bully Scottish voters using the fear factor into voting no. Banks threatened to pull jobs out of Scotland. Supermarkets, after a meeting with David Cameron, Prime Minister of Britain, threatened to increase food prices. Short of a plague of locusts, everything was promised. And to be honest, for the Yes campaign to get as near as they did, 1.6 million votes, narrowing the gap, the lead all the time, showed that a large section of the Scottish population were not intimidated by that. And there is a problem here for the United Kingdom elite. The no vote is an old vote. The independence vote is a young vote. This issue is going to come back again. It's not dead and buried for a generation. Don't believe it. And the driving force in the independence vote was not nationalism. It was an alienation from the British state, from the British elite, and from Westminster politics. And that isn't going away either. So this issue is not done and dusted in that sense. There is a widespread discontent, not just in Scotland, but across Britain with Westminster politics. And all of the parties here can't take much faith out of these elections. The SNP did not... Scottish National Party did not carry their own heartlands to a yes vote. Labour lost its traditional heartlands in the Glasgow, west of Scotland and Dundee, and I don't think it's going to get those people back. And the Tory party down south are in civil war because David Cameron had to agree to giving the Scottish Parliament extra powers in order to try and salvage a no vote, which looked like like it might lose 2 weeks ago. So there's a continuing problem for all the major Westminster parties and indeed for the Scottish Government. Few people, I think, will be quite celebrating tonight because the headaches are going to begin now.
Scottish anthem, Scotland the Brave.
I'm pleased that Congress, a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans in both the House and the Senate, have now voted to support a key element of our strategy, our plan to train and equip the opposition in Syria so they can help push back these terrorists.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama Thursday, shortly after the U.S. Senate approved a bill authorizing the training and arming of the so-called Free Syrian Army in Saudi Arabia to fight in Syria, allegedly targeting the group known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State. The Senate voted 78 to 22 in favor of the bill, which was approved a day earlier by the House of Representatives. This most recent authorization to arm and train the fighters expires December 11th. Like their colleagues in the House, a number of senators also expressed deep misgivings about the plan. This was Republican Senator Rand Paul, a Republican senator considered by pundits to have his eye on a 2016 run for the White House.
What much of the foreign policy elite fail to grasp, though, is that intervention to topple secular dictators has been the prime source of the chaos. From Hussein to Assad to Gaddafi, it's the same history. Intervention topples the secular dictator. Chaos ensues, and radical jihadists emerge. The pattern has been repeated time and time again. And yet what we have here is a failure to understand, a failure to reflect on the outcome of our involvement in Arab civil wars. Intervention that destabilizes the Middle East is a mistake. And yet here we are again, wading into a civil war. I warned a year ago that involving us in Syria's civil war was a mistake, that the inescapable irony is that someday the arms we supply would be used against us or Israel. That day's now. ISIS has grabbed up from the U.S., from the Saudis, from the Qataris, weapons by the truckload. And we are now forced to fight against our own weapons. And this body wants to throw more weapons into the mix.
Another likely presidential candidate, Republican Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, also voted against the measure. The group, alternately known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State, apparently came from nowhere and arrived on the scene as a formidable military force. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford asks, "Who's your daddy, ISIS?"
Let us be clear, if that is possible, about President Obama's plan to deal with ISIS, the boogeyman of America's own making. The president last week swore that he would degrade and destroy the Islamic State after having spent 3 years providing weapons and money to jihadist fighters, including ISIS, in hopes that they would degrade and ultimately destroy the Syrian state of President Bashar Assad. So, the Americans set out to destroy one state in Syria, whose government had never presented any danger to the U.S., and wind up creating another state, a caliphate astride the borders of Syria and Iraq, that openly declares its intention to do battle with the U.S. Obama assures us that he is assembling a new coalition of the willing to join him in smashing ISIS. It turns out that every prospective member of the coalition was a co-conspirator with the U.S. in giving birth to ISIS. Britain and France and other Europeans, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates. ISIS has many, many fathers, all of whom now deny patrimony. Obama appears to be leaving the natural gas-rich nation of Qatar out of his coalition, which doesn't seem fair, since Qatar was a loyal ally of the United States and NATO just 3 years ago, when Obama was busy trying to degrade and destroy another state, Libya, which also posed no threat to the U.S. The emir of Qatar worked his gaseous little butt off for Obama, sending money and guns and mercenaries to help the Libyan jihadists that the U.S. wanted to install as the new government. Once regime change had been accomplished in Libya, Qatar helped the Americans send hundreds of Libyan jihadists to Syria to put that regime out of business. But Libya never did get a new state to replace the one that was destroyed in 2011. Instead, the country is racked by civil war that is also a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and its friends and Qatar. It seems that Qatar backed the wrong side, the Muslim Brotherhood, after the regime change in Egypt in 2011. The Saudi Arabian royal family hates the Muslim Brotherhood because the Brotherhood advocates elections, and kings don't do elections. So the Saudis bankrolled another regime change in Egypt, putting the military back in charge, and are now fighting a proxy war with Qatar in Libya, which is why the Saudis blackballed Qatar from participating in Obama's coalition of the willing against ISIS. You do understand all this, right? Turkey, which is part of NATO, has been a wonderful father to ISIS, allowing the caliphate's fighters free use of its long border with Syria and Iraq. In return, Turkey gets to buy the cheap oil from the fields that ISIS seized from Syria and Iraq, which makes the Turks somewhat reluctant to try to kill little baby ISIS. It's starting to look like Obama might have to take out the caliphate on his own, which is why the president's top military advisor is talking about putting serious U.S. boots on the ground in Iraq and maybe in Syria. Meanwhile, Obama is putting together a new army of rebels to continue the job of degrading and destroying the Syrian state, unless, of course, these new fighters just take the money and the guns and join ISIS, too. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Mic check!
Mic check!
Wednesday marked the third anniversary of the founding of what would come to be called the Occupy Movement.
We amplify each other's voices!
We amplify each other's voices!
We amplify each other's voices!
No matter what's said!
No matter what's said!
No matter what's said!
So we can hear one another!
So we can hear one another!
So we can hear one another!
We use this human mic!
We use this human mic!
Because the police won't let us.
Because the police won't let us.
Use any kind of instrument.
Use any kind of instrument.
Beginning with a protest of several hundred against Wall Street greed, it quickly mushroomed into a national and global outcry against social and economic inequality, political and economic corruption, and the influence of corporations on government, particularly from the financial services sector. The OWS slogan, "We are the 99%, addressed income and wealth inequality in the U.S. between the wealthiest 1% and the rest of the population. Decision-making was based on consensus arrived at in general assemblies, where participants emphasized direct action over elections and petitioning authorities for redress. Caleb Maupin is an activist with the International Action Center and a freelance journalist with Press TV. He was present at the beginning of the Occupy movement and participated in some of the early planning meetings. We spoke with him by telephone Thursday. You were there at the beginning of Occupy Wall Street, down planning for the Zuccotti Park action, which began exactly 3 years ago Wednesday. Tell us about that.
Well, prior to Occupy Wall Street, I had been part of something called New Yorkers Against Budget Cuts, which was a coalition that had been formed to fight against the cuts in education the cuts in the fire departments, the cuts in the libraries, and really the fight against Bloomberg's budget. And we had actually occupied a corner of the street in Lower Manhattan and had set up kind of a round-the-clock occupation over the summer called Bloombergville. And for about a month, we had occupied this corner of the street. And it had been kind of a coalition, you know, people from different socialist groups, different communist groups, different anarchist organizations, campus groups, some factions within the teachers' unions had done this. So I heard about Occupy Wall Street on August 2nd. The first time I heard about it was on August 2nd. There was a rally on Wall Street, and that was the debt ceiling. At the time, there was this debt ceiling crisis. They were talking about a debt ceiling, and Obama was being threatened that the country would lose its credit rating if he didn't lower the budget at this time. It was a fight in Congress. And on August 2nd, there was a rally called the People's Assembly on Wall Street. And it was at that rally I met people from the Occupy Wall Street movement, and they had what was called their first General Assembly on Wall Street. And I got to say that, you know, the approach that some of those organizers had was not exactly what I was comfortable with. There was this feeling that there should be no political discussion. They kept saying that, you know, this was not going to be about politics. No, please don't bring any politics into this. And in addition, there were folks associated with some kind of right-wing groups, like the Tea Party and all that were kind of being welcomed into the discussion. And so I didn't really feel comfortable exactly. But I went to two or three more of the early General Assemblies. They were held in a park here in New York. I believe it was Tompkins Square Park in New York City. And they had, you know, their style, their democracy. But I really didn't know what was going to happen on September 17th. And, you know, I'm a member of Workers' World Party and the International Action Center. We didn't really know what to expect on September 17th. So we kind of pulled out of the planning meetings out of some political frustration. But we did finally then go down to Occupy Wall Street on September 17th. And what I saw on September 17th was something I did not expect, which was maybe 500-600 youth down by the Bull in the morning, marching with signs announcing the big corporations and calling out Wall Street. And I kind of got that electrical feeling, and that was the beginning of something. And I was really kind of happy and relieved by what I saw, and from there forward, I was involved even more.
You know, the criticism was also in the media about, you know, early on about the movement not being political, but they meant something entirely different than what you mean, I think. They were referring to the movement attaching to one or the other of the Democratic or Republican parties. And you're talking about actual political discussion, which there is still in the world, politics outside of those two parties. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I first went to Occupy Wall Street, I mean, the planning meetings that happened in the park, there was this attitude that they wouldn't discuss any issues. At the time, the Verizon workers were on strike, and we wanted the Occupy forces to endorse the strike and support the strikers. And they said, well, we can't do that because we want people who are not comfortable, who don't support labor unions, to be part of this movement. And that's not my approach. I've always felt that, you know, you have to support organized labor. You know, even if unions are right-wing and corrupt, you always support them against the boss because, you know, I mean, no matter how bad a union is, it's better to have a union than to be without one. So, I mean, it was just a difference of approach. And I think at the beginning, that's kind of what made Occupy, as much as I disagreed with it at the time, that's kind of what made Occupy so strong at the beginning, was it was so broad. You know, Occupy Wall Street was kind of able to break out of kind of the traditional way of doing things. You know, so many left-wing activists, we fall into this, well, that's the way we do things. We have the way we do things, you know, this routine we get into. I think Occupy was able to break out of that. And it was able to capture a lot more attention and really kind of get more and more people involved and excited because it was able to kind of break out of that routine. I think, though, however, that did contribute to Occupy Wall Street's decline because it could only work for so long. I mean, if you're not about anything, pretty soon people move on. You know, and that was the problem as well. I mean, there's no way to measure success. There's no way to determine if the movement's going places. People don't really have a goal to work towards. So in the beginning, it really helped Occupy to not have any demands, to not attach itself to any politicians, which I think was a really good thing that they didn't. You know, that was one of the best things about Occupy Wall Street is, as much as the Democratic Party really just wanted to make it a rally to reelect Obama, Occupy Wall Street became about something far much more. And it really was millions of people taking action independent of the ruling strata and taking action in their own hands. And I think the fact that it was so broad and so vague at the beginning really helped it really get the momentum it had, though it prevented it from sustaining itself. And I think that was problematic in the long term.
Yeah, it's interesting because the basis of it, the consensus demands, for example, about student debt and some of the other, you know, foreclosures, some of the other things were clearly class demands. And yet the types of issues that you were talking about trying to raise are, you know, they're class politics issues, unions, working people in general. And so how do you divorce class politics from what's clearly, at the base anyway, a class movement?
Well, when it gets down to it, you don't. I mean, when you're talking about the 99% and the 1%, I mean, you're talking about class struggle. You're talking about a group of billionaires that rules the world and the rest of us. Right. And, I mean, that's really what it gets down to. And I think that part of the problem with Occupy Wall Street was because it was mainly people from a younger generation. You know, I myself, I didn't grow up my life. I know the older generation grew up hearing about the Red Menace and evil communism and all that. I grew up hearing that communism was a big failure and the class struggle, socialism, Karl Marx, that's out of date. That's just, no one believes in that anymore. It's completely irrelevant. And I believe that, you know, so many of the young people that came into Occupy Wall Street had never heard anything close to what the left or the so-called left or the traditional left or the, you know, the Marxist movement, what they have to say. Most of the people that came to Occupy Wall Street, this was the first time they'd ever been to any political demonstration in their entire lives. You know, they had come to Occupy Wall Street because they heard about it on TV or they heard about it on social media and it sounded like a cool thing to do. But when you talked to them about any issue, it was like you were talking to a completely new audience. And a lot of the Occupy folks really, really just, you know, when you hear leftist talk, when you hear leftists talk and use like buzzwords and phraseology, when they heard that, it went completely over their heads and it was completely confusing to them. You know, Occupy Wall Street was kind of it was a new upsurge. It wasn't a continuation of what happened in the 60s or the 30s. It was a new upsurge of a new generation of new young people that are mad about capitalism and all of that. And as a result, it didn't, it was very hard for like the Marxist movement in general to relate to it. And I think Occupy Wall Street is symbolic of what's coming. I mean, it was just one stage. I mean, we saw what happened in Ferguson. We saw what happened in London. Prior to Occupy Wall Street, there were these London riots, which were not really political in any way, but, you know, it was a reflection of the fact that so many young people didn't have jobs. I mean, the year of 2011 is going to be remembered as a turning point. That was the year of the Wisconsin occupation of the Capitol by the labor unions. That was the year that Troy Davis was brutally executed, despite the fact that so much evidence proved he was innocent. And then that was also the year of Occupy Wall Street. It was the year of the Arab Spring throughout the Middle East. It was a year. It's a year that's going to be remembered as an important year in the history of the 21st century. You know, the question, and I think it really shows that there is a kind of an untapped potential. There are millions and millions of people in the United States who are really, really angry at this time. They're angry about their low wages, their homes being foreclosed, their jobs being shipped overseas or eliminated by technology, the low wages, the rising tuition hikes, the layoffs, the unemployment. They're also angry about cops going everywhere, the racism that goes on, the discrimination. They're mad about a lot of things that are happening. And they have the potential to get into motion and to become part of a mass movement. But as of now, they're not. And they're, you know, there's a small minority of people in the United States that are currently politically active, that are like the political movement. And that movement is often very insular. And Occupy Wall Street was one of those moments where we saw people who've never been political before, people who've never attended a demonstration, all of a sudden get political because of the material conditions, because of the economy, because of the situation that they're in, forced them to kind of wake up. And the traditional activist movement kind of was forced to try to adjust itself and to adjust itself toward something that's not facing toward other activists, but facing toward this new potential of millions of people in motion. And I think that was a problem for the left in general, and it's something that we're all still grappling with, because there's huge potential for a movement from below at this time. I mean, people are ready to move, and it's happening. We see these explosions like in Ferguson, around what happened with Trayvon Martin, the fast food struggle going on. People are in motion. The question is, how does the left, the traditional left, the traditional anti-capitalist movement that's been kind of a current in this country for the last 100 years, how do they relate to it, and how do they capture the energy of it? And that's a question that people are wrangling with.
And in terms of the energy, it was only a matter of days when suddenly a few hundred people gathering in Zuccotti Park became a global phenomenon. It spread to like 80 cities in the United States within a week, and it was around the world within 2 or 3 weeks.
Absolutely. It absolutely was. I mean, it was something that people really could relate to. And I think because it was so vague, there were a lot of forces that may not have supported it in the beginning, wouldn't have supported it if it had been a rally for jobs or a rally for healthcare, that could support it on the basis of it was a rally against Wall Street. It was an occupation of Wall Street. So it captured the imagination of millions and millions of people, the image of young people occupying Wall Street, calling out, "We are the 99%. That was something that really resonated with people, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. There's global hatred for the group of billionaires and bankers on Wall Street who rule the world, kill and bomb and drone with their drones, with their wars, their sanctions against anyone who dares stand up to them or dares fight back. There's global hatred for those forces. And it's not even just internationally. It's here in the U.S. People hate Wall Street and what it's done to them. So Occupy Wall Street, We Are the 99%, really, really caught on. It really captured something with millions of people.
And which is, of course, certainly a class analysis, if not looking at the subtle distinctions in class. It certainly saw two classes, the billionaires and everyone else, which was an interesting innovation. Looking at the material conditions that this took root in, they've only gotten worse, both in the United States and globally. If you look back at history, the Petrograd Soviet was in like 1905 or something, 12 years before the revolution in Russia that ended up reordering society on the basis of Soviets or workers' councils. The model of General Assembly worked for a while at these various occupations. Do you see maybe an embryonic structure for self-governance in the future there?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, you make the analogy about the Petrograd Soviet and all of that. And it's important to point out, the Bolsheviks didn't declare the Petrograd Soviet. They didn't put out a call urging everyone to form a Soviet. The Soviet was something the workers formed in their uprising. They naturally formed it. And the Bolsheviks and the revolutionaries were able to go into the Soviets and say, this ought to be the government, and to push the Soviets to be revolutionary. But revolutions begin generally as spontaneous events. It takes a revolutionary party or a revolutionary organization to then push them to be something bigger, to be a full-scale revolution. Mm. But people do naturally rise up and fight against their conditions. And I think it's an error to think that people are going to rise up because they get a leaflet from leftists and leftists read it, and then that just makes them rise up. People will rise up against their condition.
Right.
The question is, once the people are in motion, are revolutionaries able to get into that struggle and point it in the direction it needs to go? Because if they don't do it, then it will get pointed right back into the system toward the leadership of the old society. And I think that's something that really needs to be wrangled with and discussed, is that these uprisings that happen, people in Ferguson, Missouri, for example, they didn't rise up because, a leaflet went out saying, let's rise up in response to killing of Michael Brown. People rose up spontaneously. People do naturally fight back. And it's those spontaneous uprisings that really have the energy, the excitement to actually do something. I know Lenin talks about in one of his pamphlets, he says, at such times the people are capable of performing miracles. The masses are able to go out and commit huge acts of revolutionary excitement, take huge risks and do things. The question is, the left is able to then, the revolutionary forces are able to then point it in a direction toward actually overthrowing the entire system and not just being a place to blow off steam. And that spontaneity is a real thing. It's just a question of harnessing it and pointing it toward a new society. And that you can't write off spontaneity as a real phenomenon.
And then, of course, there are dangers, too, particularly you can see in the United States, which is so ahistorical in so many ways. In Germany, in the post-World War I period, you had a very strong socialist and communist movement, very self-aware working class, and yet they were deceived by the imagery used by the Nazis to believe that they were going to build socialism, but in Germany.
Yeah, well, the Nazi Party and all of that really was a response to what happened, right after World War I, German workers rose up, and there was a revolution, and they brought down the Kaiser, and workers' councils were created. But that revolution was betrayed. The Social Democratic Party, a party that claimed to be a socialist party but was essentially a party of the 1%, it still is in power in Germany now. It's one of the leading parties,
right.
the SDP, the Social Democratic Party in Germany. That party betrayed the revolution, and the workers had gone out and fought for it. So the fascists, when the revolutionary forces fail, that's when the right wing can come in. in response to that, there's the potential for a mass uprising. And gradually people's consciousness is coming into being. And I think we're gradually going to start seeing anti-capitalism and revolutionary sentiments become much more widespread throughout U.S. society and the rest of the Western world. The question is, what will that lead to? And will it be able to lead to the kind of revolution we need to overturn all of these oppressive relations?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.